Elizabeth Edwards is no stranger to public scrutiny. She was very much in the public eye when she was helping her husband, John, make his successful bid for the U.S. Senate. And more recently, she campaigned with him in his bids to become the Democratic candidate for president. And when he was John Kerry's running mate a couple of years ago, Mrs. Edwards wrote and spoke publicly about her battle with breast cancer. That said, it's difficult to imagine that anyone could be prepared for the torrent of criticism that's been unleashed on her since Resilience. Her most recent book was released by Broadway Books. I'm very pleased, despite that, that it has brought her back to our show today. Hi.
It's great to be with you.
This book focuses on how you dealt with three difficult events: the death of your teenage son, Wade, in a car accident in 1996, being diagnosed with and treated for breast cancer, and revelations of an affair that your husband had with a woman connected with his campaign. Let's talk about the medical stuff for a moment. In regard to your medical history, what would you like to see in President Obama's health care plan?
There are sort of a few principles that I would like to see not abandoned. He's made a commitment to having it actually be universal, meaning that if not 100% of people are covered, because getting to 100% is always very difficult, that we have made it possible for 100% of the people to have health insurance if they want it. And that we have I think it's very important that we have a public provider competing with the private providers. I think it keeps everybody a little honest if that happens. And I'd like to see us make certain that we're not making that we're making wise choices about the use of our money. Not often you see it that we're discussing who we're not going to give services to, or the limitations on the kinds of services people can get. I'd rather see us try to be more efficient in other areas. And I think by being more efficient in other areas, by using screenings more aggressively, we're going to catch diseases earlier before they become more expensive, in addition to being more debilitating, and that will keep the cost down, rather than saying to people, we're not going to cover you in end-of-life decisions, or we're not going to cover you on this rare condition.
Well, since you have some insight into the political process, this morning I heard the leading Democrat on the committee that will consider this bill, and he said, don't expect too much, actually. He said, you can't just create a whole new system. And people have been so hopeful because the campaign promised so much, and we've had all of those setbacks in the past. Why is it so hard to get something like this through?
Well, I mean, I think that that's part of the risk that President Obama took when he handed it over to Congress, is that they would start compromising with themselves before we ever got a bill. I hope that doesn't happen. I think there are enough people who have made promises to their constituents that maybe that won't happen. I think part of the problem is the language. When things that I'm talking about, universality and a public provider, don't really require a huge change in our healthcare system. The biggest changes are actually going to be the efficiencies, where we would have technology to help us with record keeping in a better way, where we would have really aggressive screenings, where we maybe increase the presence of our community health centers and our public health service so that we get that kind of initial work done maybe on the government's wallet, as opposed to our individual wallets or even the insurance company wallets, because we know in the long run it'll be to our benefit.
Even though what you've written about your husband has grabbed most of the attention, it's only a small part of your book. You told Larry King that 7/8 of the book is about things other than John's infidelity. Would it be accurate to say that the book is about coming to terms with a life that didn't turn out the way that you'd expected it to?
I think that is fair to say, and also maybe to help us eradicate the idea that our lives are going to turn out exactly as we'd planned, as the fairy tales taught us as children that they might.
Were you surprised by the strong negative reaction that was generated by some journalists and bloggers, especially women? Two of the harshest critics have been Maureen Dowd in the New York Times and Tina Brown, the editor of the Daily Beast.
I mean, women have every right to disagree with me, that doesn't bother me. I think the thing that bothers me most about the criticism is not that I mind being criticized, and people are welcome to have their own opinions, just as I'm welcome to have, I hope, my own view of what I should say. but that people reach those conclusions before reading the book.
Well, I can't help but wonder if some people are uncomfortable with your decision to write openly about what you call your husband's indiscretion because they had so admired you as a devoted wife and mother.
I hope I am still a devoted wife and mother. But when I agreed to write this book, it was because I thought that it was important to say to people who are struggling, and we have so many across the country in lots of different ways with not just the loss of a loved one or a disease or marital issues, but jobs and houses and things, their life just not turning out the way they planned, that it was worth writing and talking about the things that you that happened to you and what at least one person did, one person whose name they might know, if they're paying very close attention, did when those things happened to her life. I didn't know about John's conduct when I decided to write the book and almost didn't write it. And then I thought, well, isn't that exactly opposite what I'm trying to say here? And that is that you have to face it, you have to accept it, and recognize your life has changed. I tried, and those people I think who've read it have recognized this, I tried to be as discreet as possible and stay honest in my description of not how what my husband did, but about how I reacted.
Well, in the light of the fallout, do you have any regrets now?
Certainly in the first days, as I was getting criticism, I suppose I probably had some regrets about whether I should have done this. I think as time goes on and more people actually read the book as a whole, those 20 pages or so will seem less important than the message of the whole book.
Have you ever felt that you've been held to an unreasonably high standard? Maureen Dowd sarcastically referred to you as Saint Elizabeth.
Well, honestly, I'll be honest, we used that to as a joke in my house long before I ever heard her say that. I've tried to disabuse people of the idea that's what I represented. But, you know, I joked about myself and so did my family members using exactly the same words.
My guest is Elizabeth Edwards. Her book, Resilience, Reflections on the Burdens and Gifts of Facing Life's Adversities, published by Broadway Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I also wonder if some people are disappointed that you've decided to forgive John and move on with your life together rather than divorce him. Did you ever seriously consider that?
Well, I mean, I suppose everybody in these circumstances considers every possible outcome. One of the things that John and I did, idea that I had, and that was that we wrote what outcome we'd most like to see. Of course, the one I most wanted to see was that nothing had happened, but that given the realities that we now knew, what would the outcome we'd most like to see, and what did we individually have to do to make that outcome happen?
Well, you must have seen other families that went through similar situations and wondered why some stayed together and why some didn't.
And I think that the question is whether you find this completely out of character for the person. I think one of the reasons people were so angry with John is they found it so completely out of character with what their expectation of him and their expectation of us as a couple. And I found it out of character, and I had to weigh this conduct and how much it represented to me, and it represented a lot of pain, against the other things that I knew to be of value.
A story in the May 10th issue of the New York Times by Alessandra Stanley insinuated that you'd written the book and then talked about it on the Oprah Winfrey Show to punish John Edwards. They had the headline was rather witty. You may not like it, but it was more than one way to skin a cad.
Yes. that is witty, had that been my purpose, I certainly would have devoted more pages to it and would have been scathing. I think that I was actually worried that people were thinking I was letting him off the hook too much if you read the book itself.
Well, part of and people have suggested that. Part of the problem with talking about things like this and other things is that on the one hand, there's a hope for catharsis. On the other hand, if the response is not what you might have hoped for, you wind up with anything but a cathartic experience.
Right. Well, the cathartic experience for me anyway was the actual reading of the book. I hope that's also true for the readers as opposed to just thinking about it or talking about it. But the actual writing was, as I had to find words to describe what I was actually feeling instead of just letting the feeling wash over me.
Well, the attention for the book, I imagine, has dredged up feelings that you thought you'd put behind you. Even the New York Times ethicist Randy Cohen has written about your situation on his blog. And in a way, I think you may have given permission to for anyone to weigh in on the circumstances of your personal life.
Well, that was the thing, and I think I may have mentioned this to Larry King as well, that this is the thing that I was actually afraid of, that it didn't occur to me, honestly, beforehand, but that I gave people permission by announcing it. Same thing really happened back when I announced that the cancer had reoccurred in my bones.
And people started reading all sorts of political implications
right.
into that announcement.
Right. And this was the victory of ambition over common sense. I have tried to explain to people also when John was running and since then, I think probably one of the worst positions in the entire country would be first lady. I think Michelle Obama's doing quite a nice job of it, but it's got to be very tough work with very, you know, not much upside and lots of downside.
And I've often thought about that, the life of a political wife, because they're usually very smart. In fact, probably as smart as the spouse. In some cases, it is a husband with a wife who has succeeded in politics, but usually the other way around, and you're in, and you have to smile no matter what's happening, and you may not even agree with certain positions that your spouse takes on certain issues, and yet you've got to be the loyal wife. I've often thought about Pat Nixon in relation to Richard Nixon and all of the pain that she must have suffered.
Well, I think that was a different time, and that actually almost immediately after that, we had an entirely different model in Betty Ford, who was clearly her own woman, expressed her own opinions, which are different from her husband's, revealed her problems, the problems that she had in a candid way that I think was actually extraordinarily helpful. And maybe we don't know exactly when to credit it, but I think perhaps Betty Ford is a good place to start with the changed model, Eleanor Roosevelt being an exception that doesn't I don't think that changed the model the way that Betty Ford did.
There are rumors that Nancy Reagan used to whisper the answers to Ronald Reagan. I don't know if that's true. But then we had the situation with Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, and people judged her for all sorts of things, for not being wifey enough. They judged her for not leaving him when it turned out that he had the Monica Lewinsky. Yes, there was criticism of I've forgotten his name. Isn't that terrible? But the guy who ran the Democratic Party for a while and ran for president from Vermont, is it? Anyway,
Howard Dean.
Yeah, Howard Dean. They were critical of his wife for staying back home and practicing medicine when she should have been out there smiling by his side.
Yeah. I think that people who disagree with the candidate will find a reason to disagree with the choices that the candidate's family make as well. And I think it's just an opportunity to find another avenue of attack as opposed to something that's truly inspired by the conduct. I think that of the spouse. I think that Hillary Clinton will say that in the 1988 race, 1992 race, that she made some mistakes in that in terms of that where people might have thought she was belittling a lifestyle that a lot of people had embraced.
I'm hearing breathing being rather difficult for you. Is that because of your illness, or is that you just got a cough or something?
No. Though this may sound a little distasteful, one of the things they don't tell you happens is that you, in addition to losing your hair, you also lose your nasal hair.
Oh, my.
And
cilia and cilia.
Some of my hair came back, but among the ones that did not come back was my nasal hair. So I have a constant kind of cold going on.
Let's talk a bit about your father, who you write about. He was a decorated Navy pilot stationed in Japan for much of your childhood. How did growing up in the relatively isolated environment of a military base in a foreign country help form your ideas of the path that your life would or should take?
Well, one of the things that is different about living in a military community, you might think, even if you live in a small town, although small towns are probably closer to military communities than other places, is that you constantly feel you're being watched. In fact, you are. And your conduct will have repercussions. In the case of a military family, it'll have repercussions for the person who's serving. And so you feel responsible for your conduct very early on, and you realize, you know, any mistake could be the one that ends a career well planned. And so you're very cautious, very thoughtful about that. I think living in a foreign country was helpful to me. I think it was helpful to President Obama as well to have that different kind of experience.
What about the military culture, being a good soldier, also believing that if you work hard and achieve what you'd set out to do, you'll be rewarded?
And that is exactly what the military does. I mean, there are ranks. You meet certain goals, you perform well, then you get the next higher rank. And with the higher rank comes not just more pay, but better housing. You go to a nicer club or a nicer pool if your father is an officer as opposed to a non-commissioned officer or an enlisted man. And so you see, you see real consequences to the behavior in the life that you get to enjoy.
But it
doesn't play out in real life that way exactly.
Well, you'd lived near Hiroshima and seen the horrible destruction that atomic bombs had wreaked on a civilian population, many of them totally innocent. They were not responsible for the war. So you must have known on some level that even if you believe that deep down God will reward good behavior and reserve punishment for those who've done wrong, it doesn't always work that way.
I should have probably, although I certainly was struck by the lessons of walking the streets of Hiroshima not that long after the bomb was dropped. There were still plenty of people on the streets who had bore the scars from that bomb. But you would have thought that might have come into play in my vision of what my God was. But honestly, as would the pictures you see from Africa or the pictures we get now from Haiti. But honestly, it didn't. I still thought that if I followed the rules, I was going to have a long life, and everything would turn out swell. But that I had to reform a lot of those visions when it wasn't something as abstract as somebody else's life, but it was my own life and the death of our son Wade, who was by any stretch of the imagination innocent.
We'll come back to Wade and other matters after we take a little break. My guest is Elizabeth Edwards, author of the New York Times bestselling memoir, Saving Graces, now Resilience, Reflections on the Burdens and Gifts of Facing Life's Adversities, published by Broadway Books. Stay with us. We're back with Elizabeth Edwards. Her latest book, Resilience, Reflections on the Burdens and Gifts of Facing Life's Adversities, is published by Broadway Books. And you've said, Elizabeth, that your life did largely adhere to the storybook path that you'd anticipated until your oldest son, Wade, was killed in 1996. You were a respected attorney, had married a handsome man whose ideals you shared, had a lovely home and two happy and healthy children. For anyone not familiar with the story, will you tell us a bit about the accident that killed your son?
Wade was 16 years old, for spring break, the entire family was going to the beach. We had bought him a car, which he needed because he had a part-time job, actually, with my husband's law firm, and would do a lot of driving as part of that. So he had, at least maybe 15,000 miles of experience. Not an enormous amount, but as it turned out, not quite enough. Because when he was driving to the beach, he drove ahead of us with another boy in the car, and the wind caught his car, pushed it to the side of the road. When he tried to get it back on, he overcorrected and the car flipped. The boy next to him walked away, thank goodness, and Wade was killed instantly. There was an EMT directly behind him. He wasn't speeding. This was a kid who didn't drink or use drugs. He just didn't know how to react in those circumstances. Maybe age didn't make any difference. Maybe none of us would have known exactly how to react. But whatever the reason, he died instantly. And our daughter, who was 14 years old at the time, ended up moving down into our room, living with us for a couple of years, instead of living upstairs on the floor she used to share with her brother.
And you've described not being able to accept that Wade was dead for months after his accident. Even convince yourself that if you prayed hard enough, God might turn back time so that he would still be alive.
The first reaction is denial. It can't possibly be so. And although I looked at his body in the morgue in Duplin County, I knew that he was dead. It still was just something that I could not accept. My mother, who's got dementia, is having the same problem with my father's death, and I don't think she's probably die with the idea that he's just, you know, eating lunch someplace else today. I finally did come to terms with the fact that he had died, but not before I would do things like, you know, open drawers thinking that this 6-foot boy must be in it, or, you know, in my mind telling people to quit building a porch on the front of their house, that it was going to make it a lot easier for God if we didn't change things to turn time back.
You know, this is not unique. Today I had an experience. I just recently lost a loved one, died in January. And I don't know why, but I suddenly thought maybe she really isn't dead, and the memorial service was all a farce. I don't know why I would think such a thing, that it was all a farce or something. But we don't. If we love somebody, we don't want them to be gone.
Right. And so there's a part of us that just holds on to the idea that maybe they really aren't. I mean, there are a lot of people who would say that's what religion is, this idea that they may be gone from this life, we're going to be reunited in the next life. You know, I sure hope that's right. That would be a wonderful thing to have happen.
Was your faith seriously tested when God didn't turn back time and allow Wade to live?
It was more tested by the fact that Wade had died, because I really thought that, you know, if Wade lived the right way, and he really was a generous, sweet child, I mean, he wasn't perfect. We say, you know, it was really hard to get that boy to take the trash out. But in terms of the essential qualities that he had, he was as good as you could expect a 16-year-old to be. And yet his life was taken really by the wind. Which in Job is the hand of God.
Well, some people would have reacted with anger to all that you've been through. Have you ever felt like you needed to scream or break something?
I have, and it's one of the nice things about being able to get in a car and drive someplace out on the road. And if you want to scream, just to scream as loud as you want and as long as you want, and not have anybody think that something terrible has happened.
There are, after incredibly terrible things happen, like the Holocaust, for example, some people lost their faith in God and others became more religious.
I think that part of becoming more religious, at least it seems to my grief community that I've noticed, is part of this need really to keep them alive, the need to believe that that there is some reason why this person is dead and that you will in fact be reunited with them. And the testing is a disappointment that the rules that you thought existed didn't control the very most important things in your life.
And you've written in both Saving Graces and in this book about connecting with other grieving parents online after Wade's death. Didn't you sometimes envy the parents whose faith hadn't been shaken, who firmly believed that their child was in heaven and that they would be reunited someday?
Absolutely. I think that's an enormous gift. Faith is harder work than a lot of people think it is. To be truly faithful and to follow your faith where it takes you is hard work. But if you do that, it's a great blessing to you.
Was your faith also shaken when you were diagnosed with breast cancer in 2004?
It really wasn't. As things started to happen, you wanted to say, you know, did I do something wrong, God? Or do I need to know what I've done? In truth, after Wade's death, everything else seemed so small by comparison that the peace that I had come to about Wade's death, which is that I had a God who wasn't going to intervene no matter how many times I prayed, no matter how well I behaved. He was going to let the circumstances of the life we've created here on Earth, maybe with carcinogens and certainly with cars that can run off roads, that's the world we've created and we will live in it. At the end, you know, the God in which I now believe offer salvation and understanding, but not intervention.
Well, whether you believe in God or not, when you are diagnosed with a serious illness, you do believe that you're going to beat it.
Right. And as a matter of fact, when I first had breast cancer the first time around, I almost thought of it as the flu. I'm going to have to take medicines. None of that's going to be pleasant. But then I'm going to, you know, be cured of this flu or breast cancer, and it will be behind me. I honestly, you know, I wish I could say I treated it more seriously, but I think maybe Wade's death gave me permission.
You can't stop cancer from metastasizing, which is what happened.
No, I can't. And, you know, although I don't blame myself for the metastasis. I don't know what caused the cancer. Hopefully one day we'll find out what causes cancer. But in the interim, all I could do was follow the directions that my doctors gave me, which I did. But the cancer did come back. And the second time, I didn't think it was flu. I thought this is serious, and this is going to be the story. This is going to invade the storyline of the rest of my life.
You said that the cancer would have won if it had kept you from doing what was important to you when John was running for president. You've written, "Death is inside me, waiting patiently, and it, not I, will decide when an ache is more than an ache, and that is my new reality."
And it is. And I think most people who have cancer would tell you pretty close to the same thing, that you know it's there and you know you're going to get a little sign. You just don't know whether that ache is the sign you've been dreading.
So how are you feeling then? You're taking chemo. Obviously, you lost all the nasal hair.
Yes, right. And hair on the top of my head. I have places that look like a map of Detroit on the back of my head. But they... I am achy. I have a certain amount of achiness, and I'm happy to live with it. Because as long as I remain stable, and I've been with some slight variations, been pretty stable since the diagnosis in March of 2007.
My guest is Elizabeth Edwards. Her latest book, Resilience, published by Broadway Books. Well, how has your day to day life been affected by the reemergence of the cancer? Do you still have the energy you did?
I don't have the energy. Though I have to say, I have young children, and in 6 weeks or so, I'll turn 60. So I it's a little hard for me to pinpoint exactly why I sometimes eat dinner in my nightgown. But the truth is, I do sometimes do that.
And you still have all those pleasures that you had before. I didn't know until I read this book that you were such a huge fan of the American Songbook. You've compiled your own book to hold a collection of lyrics to 5,000 songs?
5,000 songs. In a God of DeVita's not in it. It has to be something you could actually sing. And
it's more likely Cole Porter and Irving Berlin.
Exactly.
George Gershwin.
That's right.
Not Eminem.
Not Eminem. I don't know the tunes to those songs. So it has to be something that you might sit on the porch on summer vacation and sing. And I always use Country Roads. If people can think to themselves about singing Country Roads, they basically know one line of it.
Mm-hmm. And then they're... Take me home, kind of to the place where I'm from.
Then something.
West Virginia or something.
But this gives you the chance to actually finish the whole song.
And are you doing that a lot? You sit around, you pull out the songbook and say, oh, gee.
Well, the truth is I know most of the songs, so I don't have to pull it out so much. But
you know all the lyrics to Country Roads?
Is this going to be a test?
No, I'm just wondering whether you are the person.
I'm not positive I know all the words to that, but I know all the words to Calendar Girl, for example. Things that have some sense to the way that they progress in the song.
So what's happened more recently? You're spending a lot of time with your family when you're not on a book tour. And what is life like? I mean, how aware are your kids of all of the complications that you've written about?
My children know about everything.
How old are your children?
Well, my daughter's 27, certainly does.
She reads the newspaper.
She reads the newspaper. She goes to she's just finishing school, law school. So she's, certainly right there in a information zone where she gets every bit of the good and the bad.
That's Kate. What was her reaction to the book?
Well, she read it before, she did her line edits on it for me. But I think that she had a positive response to the book. And the younger children, they have computers, they get on the internet, they certainly know about the things that have happened. John and I had a conversation with him about the most recent obstacle to our marriage, but the cancer has been something we've been honest with him about, not with a huge amount of detail on either of those subjects because they don't understand them. And they know that Wade is their brother they've never met, although Emma Claire did think for a period of time that she hadn't met Wade, but and only Jack never knew him.
And you must have thought about what will happen when the younger children read this book.
I there wasn't a sentence that I wrote that I did not think about how they would respond.
Do you hope they learn something from it?
Maybe. And maybe it'll put one of the cathartic advantages of having written the book is that I had to actually take those feelings, which are so raw, and put them into words that are by nature less raw, and I, and in doing so, I perhaps got an easier picture to handle for myself. Maybe this will do the same thing. My children lived in my house for all of this time. It's not like we lived someplace and they lived someplace protected. They lived in the same house, ate at the same table, and were part of a lot of the discussions that took place.
I'm assuming that you had John read the book before it was published as well.
I told him anytime he could read it. He didn't read it until Galleys. So he, it was pretty close to finished product.
Did he suggest that you change anything?
No, he did. He did a few line edits when he thought that I had made a grammatical mistake or a word choice wasn't right. But he didn't. He made no substantive changes at all or suggestions.
You've written recently opened a furniture store near your home in North Carolina. Why did you get into that business?
Well, I have to say I've been in there organizing it and setting it up, so it's basically set up. But with the book tour and the responsibilities associated with that, the opening will actually probably be next month. But I did it because I really enjoy doing it. I mean, one of the things I think I've been good at doing in my life is creating a home, and so I've tried to keep playing that out now that my own house is completely filled with every piece of furniture I could possibly want.
If you hadn't been a politician's wife and been forced to devote yourself to being there all the time, would you have wanted to have done something like this earlier?
Well, maybe. I think that it's a good counterpoint to the, I was very and still very interested in policy and work as a senior fellow in healthcare for the Center for American Progress. And I think maybe just having the furniture store wouldn't have been enough, but it's a great counterpoint to that, where I can let all the rest of the world float away and its problems and decide whether or not I should put the green vase next to the red couch.
This is a difficult question for me to ask. I'm not going to go into details, but people do read the newspapers. Do you fear that more information is going to come out, more embarrassing information that you still don't know about?
I have no idea. I hope that my husband has been honest with me.
Well, he hasn't always been in the past.
I know. In the recent, most recent future, I hope he's been completely honest with me. If he hasn't been, and I'm surprised again, that would be a really severe blow.
Mm-hmm. But that's all just part of the. At this point, I think you almost probably have calluses on your soul. Elizabeth Edwards' book, Resilience, Reflections on the Burdens and Gifts of Facing Life's Adversities, published by Broadway. You going to write another book?
I don't have one in mind. People are constantly making suggestions to me, all of which sound wonderful for someone to write, but I don't know whether I will or not.
Well, people always have great ideas for you to write rather than for them to write. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Edwards will be giving a reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Union Square Barnes & Noble store. And I imagine you've been meeting people all over the country. Most of them have been strongly supportive.
They have. If it wasn't the chattering class, but just human beings, I feel I got a great response to the book.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.